It was early in the fall, and the blowing up the squall from the terrace, you could hear the weirdest moans. With a mighty lonesome cry came a whistle from the sky, and it chilled the very marrow in my bones. Then a loud rushing roar like you never heard before turned the blood to icy water in my veins. As I watched with rising fear, something strange was drawing near, and I saw in the clouds ghost train. Number 9 were racing through the night. Just as they passed me by, I heard the engineer cry, "Give her coal, give her coal, shovel it on." You could see the fireman grinning in the engine that was winning, but I knew before the finish they'd be gone. See the drivers roll as they shovel on the coal, and the black smoke came pouring from the stacks. As they thundered through the sky, I am here to testify, you could hear the wheels a-clickin' on the tracks. Through the smoke and the steam, you could see the headlights gleam. Now I have no proof, but still the fact remains. You may doubt it, but I swear there was cinders in my hair when I saw in the clouds ghost train.
Ghost train, what a terrible sight.
The cannonball and number 9 were racing through the night. Just as they passed me by, I heard the engine it cry, "Give her coal, give her coal, shovel it on." You could see the fireman grinning in the engine that was winning. As I watched, I saw him fade into the dawn.
Well, there he goes, Ghost Train with Hank Snow, one of my all-time favorites. He sang a whole lot of train songs during his career. Very popular. He has had many songs on the top of the hit parade, especially the country western, over the years. Hank Snow is from Nova Scotia. Yeah, he started out as a country western singer at a little radio station in Nova Scotia. I think he's only about 5 foot tall, maybe not even that tall. Well, let's get down to business here. It is the 10th month, October 22nd, 2014, Wotan's Day. David Lane's favorite day. Yeah. And it's a beautiful day. Little nippy, got down into the 30s last night. Whoa. Yeah, but it's a nice day. The sun's out. You just have to wear a coat. However, when I go downtown around here, I can't believe how many kids and adults are walking around with t-shirts on. And sometimes even into snowy weather. Unbelievable, man, I'll tell you. You know, they always saying that black people don't like cold weather like that. Well, hell, yesterday it was pretty cool. I saw the black guy downtown with nothing but a t-shirt on. And if you think that's something else, I used to talk to the guys up in Anchorage, Alaska, and they said, "Yeah, we got a nigger problem up here." I said, "A nigger problem in Alaska?" They said, "Yeah, we got quite a number of them up here." So I guess that old wives' tale isn't true. I think a couple of the Arctic explorers had a couple of black guys on the ship, too. I wonder if any of you people ever read the Russian Constitution. I've got a copy here on my desk. It's hardbound, and it's got the Soviet crest on the front. And it's small, but I'll tell you what. Let's hear about civil rights and so forth in Soviet Union. Now, don't laugh. they in their constitution. That just shows you what a constitution means. Article 118, citizens of the USSR have the right to work. That is, they're guaranteed the right to employment and payment for their work in accordance with its quantity and quality. The right to work is ensured by the socialist organization of the national economy. The steady growth of the productive forces of the Soviet society. The elimination of the possibility of economic crisis. Yeah, because it was always in a crisis. And the abolition of unemployment. Sounds like a right to work here, doesn't it? Right to work cheap. A right to work and not be able to support yourself or your family. Article 119, citizens of the USSR have the right to rest and leisure. Huh. The right to rest and leisure is ensured by the reduction of the working day to 7 hours for the overwhelming majority of workers. The institution of annual vacations with full pay for workers and employees, and the provision of a wide network of sanatoria, rest homes, and clubs for the accommodation of working people. But you never knew that about the Soviet Union, huh? Article 120, citizens of the USSR have the right to maintenance in old age and also in case of sickness or loss of capacity to work. This right is ensured by the extensive development of the social insurance of workers and employees at state expense. Free medical service for the working people and the provision of a wide network of health resorts for the use of the working people. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Article 121, citizens of the USSR have the right to education. Whenever they tell you it's a right, they're full of shit. The right is ensured by universal compulsory elementary education, by education including higher education, being free of charge, by the system of the state, stipends for the overwhelming majority of students in the universities. And colleges, by the instruction in schools being conducted in the native language and by the organization in the factories, state farms, machine and tractor stations, and collective farms of free vocational, technical, and agronomic training for the working people. It's getting better all the time, right? Article 122, women in the USSR are accorded equal rights with men in all spheres of economic, state, cultural, social, and political life. The possibility of exercising these rights is ensured to women by granting them equal right with men to work, payment for work, rest and leisure, social insurance, and education, and by state protection of the interests of mother and child, pre-maternity and maternity leave with full pay, and to provision a wide network of maternity houses, homes, nurseries, and kindergartens. Hey, this is getting better all the time, right? Yeah, it's a wonder the whole world didn't immigrate to the USSR. The strange thing is there were so many trying to get out. They must have been crazy. Article 123. Equality of rights of citizens of the USSR, irrespective of their nationality or race, in all spheres of economic, state, cultural, social, and political life is an indefeasible law. Any direct or indirect restriction of the rights of, or conversely, any establishment of direct or indirect privileges for citizens on account of their race or nationality, as well as any advisory advocacy of racial or national exclusiveness or hatred and contempt is punishable by law. There you go. In order to ensure to citizens' freedom of conscience, the church in the USSR is separated from the state, and the school from the church. Freedom of religious worship and freedom of anti-religious propaganda is recognized for all citizens. Article 125. In conformity with the interests of the working people, and in order to strengthen the socialist system, which it was not a socialist system, the citizens of USSR are guaranteed by law, A, freedom of speech, B, freedom of the press, C, freedom of assembly, including the holding of mass meetings. It's almost like they copied this off the American Constitution. Freedom of street possessions and demonstrations. Freedom of street processions, in other words, demonstrations. These civil rights are ensured by placing at the disposal of the working people and their organizations, printing presses, stocks of paper, public buildings, the streets, communication facilities, and other material requests for the exercise of these rights. In conformity, this is Article 126, in conformity with the interests of the working people, and in order to develop the organizational initiative and political activity of the masses of the people, citizens of the USSR are ensured that the right to unite in public organizations, trade unions, cooperative associations, youth organizations, sport and defense organizations, cultural, technical, and scientific societies, and the most active and politically most conscious citizens in the ranks of the working class and other sections of the working people unite in the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Bolsheviks, which is the vanguard of the working people in their struggle to strengthen and develop the socialist system, and is the leading core of all organization of the working people, both public and state. Article 127, citizens of the USSR are guaranteed inviolable of the person. No person may be placed under arrest except by decision of a court or with the sanction of the procurator. Gee, I wonder what happened to KGB, and it doesn't say anything about the KGB or the Cheka here. Article 128, the inviolability of the homes of citizens and the privacy of correspondents are protected by law. Oh, man. The USSR affords the right of asylum to foreign citizens persecuted for defending the interests of the working people, or for their scientific activities, or for their struggle for national liberation. Article 130. It is the duty of every citizen of the USSR to abide by the Constitution of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, to observe the laws, to maintain labor discipline, honesty to perform public duties, and to respect the rules of socialist intercourse. Whoa. I wonder if that socialist intercourse is any different than capitalist intercourse. Article 131. It is the duty of every citizen of the USSR to safeguard and strengthen public socialist property as the sacred and inviolable foundation of the Soviet system, as a result of the wealth and might of the country, as the source of the prosperous and cultured life of all the working people. Persons committing offenses against the public socialist property are enemies of the people. Wow. Article 132, universal military service is law. Military service in the workers' and peasants' Red Army is an honorable duty of the citizens of the USSR. Article 133, to defend the fatherland is the sacred duty of every citizen of the USSR. You know, this Constitution is very much like ours. treason to the country, violation of the oath of allegiance, desertion to the enemy, impairing the military power of the state. Espionage is punishable with all the severity of the law as the most heinous of crimes. And that's the end of that particular section of the Soviet Constitution. What do you think about that? Pretty cool, huh, man? They gave rights all over the place. Everybody had rights to do about whatever they wanted to, as long as they didn't disagree with the system. But when they talk about a socialist state, it was not a socialist state. It had a veneer of socialism, but it was actually state capitalism. That's perfect state capitalism, because when they run the show, predatory capitalists, they'll talk about rights and freedom and all that kind of stuff, and in reality there's not much of it. So see, they give socialism a bad name. Socialism, Aryan socialism, is successful and good to lots of white people around the world. But when these guys talk about socialism, that causes most of the people to say, well, socialism is bad. Well, of course, Soviet so-called socialism was bad. But it wasn't really socialism. Not in the context that I would use the term socialism, Aryan socialism. I mean, Denmark and Sweden, most of those countries over there operate on socialism. And they may have their problems, but they're doing better than we are. That's for sure. Anyhow, I thought you might find that interesting. In fact, in the end, National Socialist Germany was not operating as a socialist nation at all. They had a veneer of socialism, but they were really state capitalist. And, of course, whenever state capitalism gets into control or has a lot of power, it always ends up in war. Name me one country that has adopted national capitalism in some form that doesn't end up in wars, maybe all the time. So if true Aryan socialism had been followed in Germany, there probably wouldn't have been a World War II, unless somebody attacked Germany physically. So just remember that. If they'd adhered to Strasserist socialism in Germany, there would not have been a war that killed, what, 200 million? Millions of people died, not because of socialism, but because of not operating as white socialists, Aryan socialists. In fact, it was the socialists, the so-called socialists, with state capitalists in the Soviet Union that were attacked by the state capitalists of Germany. It's an interesting way to think about it. I say the same thing about China. China has been, for a very, very long time, ruled by state capitalism under a phony name of communism or socialism. It may have had certain programs that were socialist, but at the top, it's been run by state capitalism, where the capitalists, under one name or another, control everything. Remember, capitalism's idea is to get all the capital, centralize all the capital, and 2 or 3% of the world's population control everything. That's predatory capitalism, and it's in full force right now in this country, and Europe, of course. One of the few white nations, or pretty much white, Soviet Russia, is not nearly as run by state capitalism as the rest of the West. So that's interesting. Everything is sort of flip-flopped. However, predatory capitalism has a big in Russia. It does control a lot. But I don't think it's quite as much as in the West. Putin appears to be a nationalist, and a true nationalist would not be going along with state capitalism. However, it's pretty hard for any big leader to escape it. So I will not put trust in Putin over the long haul any more than I would the last 20 presidents of the United States. Why are teenage girls of Europe joining up with ISIS? Well, probably because they want the same things that teenage boys want, a strong sense of meaning and purpose. Teenage girls are the West's center of gravity, virtually all of Western pop culture. The key to our soft power is tailored to the tastes of teenage girls through the wonders of information technology. The mobile phone mass-produced the mores and habits of phone-mad teenage girls locked in their bedrooms. Indeed, Western civilization is a success largely insofar as it has made the world a safe place for teenage girls to go to school, to get a job, and decide who and when to marry, or if they want to marry at all. When teenage girls turn away from the One Direction and embrace ISIS, it means the West is losing. A Washington Institute poll last week showed that the Islamic State has more support in Europe than it does in the Middle East. The poll reported that only 3% of the Egyptians, 5% of the Saudis, and under 1% of the Lebanese expressed positive opinions of ISIS. On the other hand, 77% of UK respondents had a favorable view of the group, as did 16% of French polled, with 27% of French citizens between 18 and 24 responding favorably. The numbers should hardly come as a surprise. Thousands of young European Muslims have already left the continent for the Middle East to help the organization's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, build an authentic Islamic caliphate. Doubtless thousands more are on their way to kill and die for an idea they believe in, or think they believe in. It's no different than the Christians or Jews. Maybe a little more fanatical. It is a striking fact that the ISIS appeals not only to young men, but also young European women, many hundreds of whom have gone to Syria and Iraq to marry Islamic State fighters. You know what that means. Mostly white girls marrying non-white, swarthy Middle Easterners. Semites. Sure, some of them, like the 15-year-old French Jewish girl, Nora El-Bathy, may have come to regret their decision, but that hardly alters the essential point. The girls sought out the IS fighters because the West seems weak and unmanly, and they pine for real men who are willing to kill and die for what they believe in. Now, isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? Here they put down male strength, especially in the U.S. Male strength is bad. Acting like a man is bad. But yet there's girls leaving the United States and Europe all the time to get with strong Middle Eastern Semites. Why? Europe's got great health care, welfare, and lots of attractive young men and attractive women who, unlike the vast majority of women in the Middle East outside of Israel, are sexually available. So why, given a choice between a comfortable, if somewhat boring, life as a pharmacist in Hamburg or fighting and dying in the desert, are thousands of Western Muslims opting for the latter? Well, that's because they've never died, haven't died yet. It's easy to talk about fighting and dying until that time comes. Because for all the awesome social services and consumer goods it can offer, Europe has become incapable of endowing the lives of its citizens, Muslims or not, with meaning. A generation of young European Muslims are giving up their relatively easy lives in Malmo, Marseille, and Manchester for the battlefields of Syria and Iraq, because Europe is devoid of values worth living or dying for. They're leaving for the same reason the European Jews are moving to Israel. Strength and a sense of purpose can be found elsewhere, whether it's ISIS, Vladimir Putin, Ali Khamenei, or the IDF. European security services are worried about the large number of jihadist fighters with Western passports are destined to cause trouble should they come back to the continent. They're worried, they say, about the special skills militants might obtain abroad and then employ at home, like Mehdi Nemouchi, the Frenchman who killed four people at the Brussels Museum in May. European authorities are missing the much more salient point. Nemouchi may have gone to Syria to fight alongside extremist groups, but it's not like firing an automatic rifle is a specialized skill you can only learn on a jihadi battlefield. It's not like you can travel to the Middle East to learn to hate Jews. The problem isn't what European Muslims may come back with from the Middle East, but the fact that they've left Europe in the first place. Baghdadi's self-proclaimed caliphate sounds like an inside joke to ISIS's two most significant military cadres, the Arab tribes and former bosses from Saddam Hussein's regime. But to the Islamic State's foreign fighters, especially in Western European contingent, the idea of a caliphate ripped from the pages of Muslim history resonates with a kind of existential authenticity missing from the vast and drab European suburbs warehousing Muslim youth. I can understand that. I can see it in this country, too. Kids are bored to death, most of them. So they search all over the place for some kind of stimulation, any kind of stimulation. I'll go out with a nigger, maybe that'll stimulate me. And it's precisely the violence of ISIS that appeals to the Europeans. Remember Patty Hearst, who teamed up with the niggers, robbed banks and stuff? Well, this is common. White girls get bored. Why do you think white girls, beautiful white girls, get on the back of a Harley Davidson with a grubby, bearded, fat, overweight white guy? They're bored. And it's precisely the violence of ISIS that appeals to the Europeans. For the Middle East, after all, despite Ayman and al-Zawahiri's alleged claims that ISIS is too extreme even for al-Qaeda, there's nothing exceptional about the bloodshed. The level of violence, beheadings, crucifixions, and so on is par for the course in its regional politics. U.S. ally Saudi Arabia beheads criminals in the middle of Raidah and the President Barack Obama's new BFF in the region. An Iranian regime he calls rational hangs criminals from construction cranes, but for the European fighters, the violence is more evidence of authenticity. Yes, what ISIS stands for is exceedingly stupid and vicious, like the one evil transformer figures that destroys everything in its way. But this is what happens when there's a vacuum. Ugly ideas fill space. And we're moving that way in this country too, North America. Just give it a little time. Be patient, my children. Looking around, it's hard not to think that the ugly and the vicious and the stupid have upper hands these days, with little resistance from the so-called defenders of good. That's abstract, of course. Good. Just remember back in the 30s when things were tight and the economy was bad, how suddenly we had Bonnie and Clyde and all. And if you go way back into the old West, Belle Starr and her Indian cohort that went all over the West robbing people. It's the same thing. It never ends. Vladimir Putin is a hip-hop icon because he's got Europeans eating out of his hand. He rolls large and can turn off Europe's lights anytime he wants. He can, and even the czars couldn't have done that. He can go as far into the Ukraine as he likes because he knows the United States won't stop him. No, the United States is the paper tiger. Remember that when the Chinese used to call us paper tiger? We are the paper tiger. I mean, we can drop all kinds of bombs and everything, but other than that, we don't have much of an effect. Oh, except throwing money at people. Obama said that Iran won't get a nuclear weapon, but after already acknowledging the clerical regime's right to enrich uranium, the White House may now allow Iran to keep even more centrifuges. Well, why not? Why not? Israel's got all kinds of bombs. Pakistan's got the bomb. They all have the bomb. So why shouldn't Iran have the bomb? Israel may have crushed Hamas over the course of a 40-day operation Protective Edge, but here come the Western nations led by the United States hosting a donor conference that will relieve Hamas of all responsibility for having brought death and destruction to Gaza. They did? Well, I will say this, Tommy says. Shooting all those rockets into Israel, even though they were very ineffective, was propaganda that, of course, the Jews used in Israel. And things would have been a lot easier if they hadn't lobbed rockets into Israel. They'd be better off with human bombs. Like, you know, just walk into Israel and let her fly. Well, I doubt if they could get in. It'd be pretty tough with the security they've got. Why? Because they can no longer summon the vitality necessary to take down a gang of bearded terrorists with RPGs, and so they're hoping instead to buy them off. Understood. What Europe's disaffected youth see is that the Western powers roll over and take it again and again. The issue isn't that we enjoy being humiliated. It's just that we don't really believe there's anything worth fighting for. And that's why thousands of Europe's young Muslim men have taken sides against us, and why 15-year-old girls hold us in contempt. Well, of course there's something to fight for. They've been fighting over oil and all kinds of things and drugs out of Afghanistan. The people in power have plenty to fight for. But they're not fighting for the people or any people. And they're surely not rebuilding countries they've bombed into rubble. So there you go. And I agree with just about everything in that article, maybe all of it. And it's going to get worse. No, it's going to get better. Because there'll be a lot of choosing up sides in this country, in North America. For all you people who are always negative, it's never going to happen. What's going to happen? What are we going to do? Just give it time, boys and girls. Give it time. You notice all these people that, like, North Korea is arresting, and other places like that arresting, are people that are trying to spread the gospel. That's right. The guy that they just released put a Bible into a nightclub. Now, you know what the message there is. You're all a bunch of sinners, and I'm going to bring you Jesus. I wouldn't try to bail anybody out that's trying to spread Christianity into a non-Christian country, and I would not disagree with anything that happens to them. Maybe these soft-handed Christians will get the message. They start chopping their heads off and throwing them in prison for 50 years. I don't find any fault with the North Koreans for doing what they did. Well, the same thing happened with the Jews after the war for maybe 10, 15, 20 years. Jews from all over the world flocked to Israel to fight the Arabs and to defend that piece of land they stole. So all groups go through this. We haven't been through it for a long time, and that's the problem. Well, Jews in Hollywood people getting Jewish tattoos. I thought they didn't like tattoos. Well, they do all brag about it. I survived Auschwitz. but all I got was this damn tattoo. Non-Jews seem irresistibly drawn to Hebrew tattoos, perhaps even more than Sanskrit letters and Chinese symbols. Hebrew tattoos hold mysterious allure. In some cases, they're meant to convey woo-woo Kabbalistic mysticism. In others, they say, "Woo, I am so Christian, I have the original language of the Bible on me." Non-Jews don't have to struggle with cultural prohibitions against tattooing. The notion that a tattoo means that one can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery refuses to die. So while there are certainly Jews out there who choose Hebrew tattoos, for the most part, inking Hebrew letters into one's body seems to be largely a Christian phenomenon. Perhaps the most famous Jewry tattooed non-Jews on the planet are the Beckhams, former Spice Girl Victoria and underwear model, retired soccer personage David, defensive explanation. David's maternal grandfather was Jewish, but he grew up attending church, and he has humongous torso tattooed of Jesus. So I vote Goy. Both Beckhams are inked with the, I can't pronounce this, the Song of Songs wedding fave. Quote, "I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine, who browse among the lilies." Shockingly, hers is written and spelled correctly. His is ungrammatically, "My beloved Dodi is in the masculine form, but still sweet." FYI, his tattoo is above a Sanskrit rendition of his wife's name spelled wrong. Beck's also have a bonus smaller Hebrew tattoo upon his left elbow. From Proverbs 3:1, it means, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but keep my commandments in your heart," unquote. I can't find any non-blurry pictures of it, but one must assume it features the correct gender pronouns, yay. In her, quote, "Die for Another Day" video a few years back, Madonna writhed around with a lamed, a deaf, a left, and a vaw tattoo on her shoulder. What did that seemingly nonsensical letter combo mean? According to Madonna's Kabbalah leader, Yehuda Berg, that's one of the secret names for God. Number two, Madonna's version of the Kabbalah is dismissed as Jewish Dianetics by the canonical source. Jew or not Jew, so again I'm voting Goy. Okay, as it turns out, the tattoo was temporary, but Madonna annoys me so much that I'm including her anyhow. She's nuts. Poor Britney Spears, her former Kabbalah bud Madonna, reportedly encouraged her to get the letter Mem, He, and Shin tattooed on her neck. An attempt at Hashem, another of God's names. He got a lot of names, that boy. Alas, the letters were out of order. She apparently had the letters lasered off in 2008. I'm telling you, the world is crazy. Crazy nuts. Christina Aguilar broke the fundamental tattoo rule: do not get your lover's name permanently inscribed on your body. Her Jewish boyfriend Jordan Brotman's Hebrew initials inked into her left arm. I'm guessing Jordan's Hebrew name is Yardan, along with the Spanish words Te amo siempre, I love you always. She also got the ever-popular, I don't know how to pronounce this, but anyhow, along with JB tattooed on her lower back. Maybe she put JB Stoner's initials on. What if she found out JB Stoner was the most well-known guy about hating the Jews, let's put it that way. Anti-Semitic. The couple broke up in 2011. Fowey Humoculus, Justin Bieber has a tattoo reading Yeshua, Jesus' name, in Jews for Jesus, Hebrew. He got it with his dad, who got the same tattoo. No wonder he's so screwed up. I wonder if they also pee in the restaurant kitchen buckets together. The Beeb also has a picture of Jesus' face on his left leg. Someone who never existed. You can make him whatever race you want. He can be a nigger Jesus. He can be Asian Jesus. He can be white Jesus. He can be whatever you want. There you go. When something is invisible, you can make him anything you want. You can make Jesus a woman, probably. Once upon a time, my husband was the tour manager for Psychic TV, the seminal psychedelic electronic performance art group led by Genesis P. O'Ridge, who has a wrist tattoo saying Penchka T. Petsika Tav in Hebrew letters. Incoherence is probably performance art. Tween, scream could inducer and cause of concerts going dad misery. Harry Styles of the boy band One Direction has his sister's name Gemma tattooed in correct woo-hoo, where's that? Hebrew on his arm. Styles isn't Jewish, but according to the UK's Daily Mail, he loves the Jewish community. And wearing a Mogan David, all in One Direction, boys love Judaism. They're fascinated by it, and they enjoy the family atmosphere. He is also known to have called his manager a nudnik. How's that any different than the people getting all excited over ISIS? They're all fanatics. Former American Idol contestant Jordan Sparks has Hebrew letters trailing down her back, reportedly saying, quote, if I'm not myself, then who will be me? Is this narcissistic version of Hillel's famous quote, quote, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? And if I'm only myself, what am I? French swimmer Fabien Gillot has a tattoo on his upper arm. Quote, I am nothing without them. Purely as tattoo critique, this one has the best and most confident line in the bunch. It looks like someone who both knows Hebrew and has a sense of style inked in. Gillot got the tattoo in honor of his grandmother's husband, Max Goldschmidt, an Auschwitz survivor. Sadly, Goldschmidt died shortly before Gillot won the Olympic gold in 2012. New York Knicks Amar Stoudemire, part owner of the Israeli basketball team and potential bar mitzvah booker, has a tattoo of the Star of David on one hand, but the Golden State Warriors point guard Steve Curry goes bigger with a Hebrew wrist tattoo reading, Love Never Fails. It's from 1 Corinthians 13:8 in the Christian Bible. Not so Jewry, but still Hebrew. Perhaps oddly, I could find only two Jewish celebs with Hebrew tattoos. Why does Adam Levine, a.k.a. the human equivalent of testing positive for chlamydia, have a gazillion tattoos from a zillion cultures, but none of them Jewish? For non-Israel Jews, famous and not, Hebrew tattoos seem to be the way to connect with one's own heritage rather than co-opt someone else's. Adam Polly of the unfairly prematurely canceled unrated and awesome sitcom Happy Endings has his own Hebrew name, Asher, which is also his grandfather's name, tattooed on his chest. Former Juicy editor Lil Marcus noted that Polly's character's name was Max, and the tattoo was never explained on the show. Therefore, I'm going to retcon it and say that Max had a Jewish boyfriend back in the day and got his name tattooed on him and just hasn't bothered to remove it yet. And now I'm going to think about which cute Jewry actor they can get to play Asher in the flashback. Missed opportunities. It's not the best tattoo. I got it when I was 19. Now it looks like I was in Tel Aviv prison and that I'm someone's property. You probably were someone's property. Baseball's Hebrew Hammer, the one who was not Hank Greenberg or Al Rosen, who did not abuse steroids. I think that covers all baseball hammers. Gabe Kapler has legs covered in Jewish tattoos. On his left calf, he's got a Star of David that Hebe magazine said was as big as a chocolate chip cookie, to which I would add not a Chips Ahoy, a Pepperidge Farm Soft Baked. It is surrounded by Hebrew letters supposedly reading strong-willed, strong-minded. I can't find a picture with enough of a close-up to corroborate this or critique the Hebrew. And oh, why didn't he talk to Fabian Gilad about finding an artist who was skilled at lettering? On his right calf, the rugged, handsome, but underperforming player has the English words "never again," plus a flame and the dates 1933 and 1945. He also has his ex-wife's name, Lisa, tattooed on his bicep. He and Lisa divorced in 2013. He should have talked to Aguilera about the curse of the name tattoo. Well, there you go. You're not going to find that information in many places. But you found it here on the White Harriet Resistance Radio. You never know what you're going to get on this radio station. Incidentally, once in a while somebody sends me an audio script of some of these radio shows around that are sort of pro-white and sort of anti-Jew and so forth like that. Of course, they never say nigger, you know. A whole bunch of young guys out there putting on these radio shows. And they don't have any education about race at all. They don't know anything really about history. But they just go on and on. I was sent one yesterday. I listened to it. They're juvenile. They don't know what the hell they're talking about in most cases. I don't know where they're getting their information, but it's surely not from us old-timers. And I got a feeling they don't want to get any information from us old-timers. It's the last breath, gasp of the right wing. It's got to go. But anyhow, all these non-Jews, these Christians, are getting more Jew tattoos than the Jews themselves. Quite interesting. You know, there's a lot of news guys that turn me off. In fact, most of them do, but there's one that really turns me off, and that's Wolf Blitzer. That little kike drives me crazy because he's got no talent. I mean, he's not a concrete type person or any of the very good announcers and news broadcasters. He's boring. And the only reason he's got that goddamn job is because he's a Jew. I mean, it can't be. That's like Al Sharpton. He isn't worth a shit. He's horrible. Not only looking, but talking. I don't know. He's getting skinnier and skinnier. But anyhow, let's talk about Wolf Blitzer. Wolf Blitzer is the latest participant in CNN's Roots series, in which the cable news network has its hosts, talking heads, exploring their family history on air. Oh, that's wonderful. I'm very interested. Blitzer's installment, which aired last week, runs at two speeds, saccharine and deeply moving. Wolf begins his 14-minute journey in Buffalo, New York, where he grew up, where adoring locals actually chant his name when he walks into a bar. I'd be saying, get the fuck out of here because you don't have any talent at all. The second, more sobering segment features Blitzer traveling first to to Yad Vashem. Oh yeah, we got to go over there, man, and go all through that again in Jerusalem, and then to Auschwitz and the surrounding town in Poland. I think Jews really get off on genocide, or what they call genocide. I think Jews, you know, if you read what and listen to what I said about Karl Marx and these Jews back in history, it's like they're saying, hit me, hit me, hit me. It feels so good. Masochists, you know, horrible things that happen to you and your family. Wouldn't you tend to, over time, try to forget it? Try to walk away from it and not wallow in this crap that they have? Maybe that has to do with their excitement over toilet humor, like most of the Jewish comedians have. And now they've spread it to most of the non-Jewish comedians. They have a thing about shit, just like I read to you yesterday. I think that all has to do with like this. They wallow in being persecuted. In fact, they'll do things to get persecuted so they can wallow in it. Some people would say, oh, they wouldn't do that. Bullshit, they wouldn't. They do. I'll bet you the person that really started chains and leather and getting whipped and tied to the bedpost and all that stuff was a kike. I'll bet you the ones that started were kikes. Anyhow, Blitz's family took a route so archetypical in the 20th century Jews, it could be called Rothian. Polish family suffers immeasurable loss during the Holy Cause, survived out of ingenuity and luck, moves to America to become just another parasite, of which he certainly is a parasite on CNN. I hardly ever watch CNN for the news, and if he comes on, or him and Al Sharpton, those guys, of course, he's Al Sharpton's on MSNBC, but if I happen to be on there and those guys come on, I turn it off immediately because they're so horrible. Blitzer, inspired by what he learned at Yad Vashem, travels to Auschwitz after touring the former concentration camp grounds. He teams up with a local historian to find out more information about his family. What kind of criminality were they in before the Germans rounded them up? Yes, the search is largely fruitless. Nobody remembers his family. What are you talking about? I don't know that guy. Here we see a curious type of frustration from Blitzer on the CNN anchor. Doesn't seem to be used to. They can find addresses in old factories, but when they go door to door seeking some, any memory of the names written on a piece of paper, they come up blank. What do you mean, Blitzer? Those fuckers, I don't remember them. If they were, they were criminals. Now get out of here. Though the segment quickly moves past this dead end, this is a story for which characters are necessarily, after all, it speaks to one of the most insidious aspects of genocide. There'll never be anything any worse to anybody better. Nobody will ever have as much pain as we've had. Oh, and we'll never forget it. Isn't it wonderful? We'll make movies out of it. How it removes the individual. And that reminds me of this Brad Pitt movie, another goddamn anti-German movie. Can't they ever get over that stuff? They've got Christians acting like Jews, of course. Let's have another anti-German movie. Blitzer is up there with John Stewart on the list of prominent Jews from whom Americans get their news daily basis. Well, hell, John Stewart may be a Jew, but at least he's funny, and you get more real news out of his show than you do out of Blitzer. He's a Camp Ramaha alum, I don't know what that is, who has never been shy about his religion or defending the Jew state of Israel, from critics for that matter. That he's willing to put a human face on the tragedy of the Holocaust is good, of course, but he is willing to show the empty spaces where human faces once existed, but no longer do. feels crucial. Oh, Blitz, I feel so fucking sorry for you. I just want to reach out and grab you by the back of your head and bash it into a marble table. No, that would be too good. That would be too good and final. I think one of the reasons people all over the world can't stand the Jews is because they're feeling sorry for themselves about everything. But yet you look at the top bankers running around in New York City on Wall Street. You look at the movie industry. You look at just about any area of commerce, and there's Jews at the top. But they're always saying, feel sorry for us. Feel sorry for us. I'll tell you one group of people that don't buy that, that's the niggers. Well, at least most of them. I don't know whether you're interested, but quite a few of these celebrities attended Jew camp. No, not Auschwitz. That was the best camp. Anyhow, what do Wolf Blitzer, Ben Bernanke, and B.J. Novak have in common? Bonfires and bunk beds, of course. These Camp Rama veterans are just a few of the many famous Jews listed on the famous alumni section of Summer Camp Culture, our new favorite website. Like all classic camp stories, this one is clickery. It looks like the serious kids flocked to one camp, while the comedically inclined kids went elsewhere. Ralph Lauren, Alan Dershowitz, and Noam Chomsky all went to Camp Mossad in Pennsylvania, while actor Brian Greenberg of How to Make It in America and the Coen brothers headed for Wisconsin's Camp Herzl. The list of Jewish camp alumni goes on, with Seth Rogen spending his summers at Camp Miriam in Canada and Mattishua attending Kutcher's camp in Monticello, New York. The real question, although, is whether any of these autograph-worthy people were in your bunk, or better yet, if they signed their signing pillow. Well, that's enough of that crap. Let's get away from talking about the Jews a little bit here. I'm going to take a shower. Well, if you live in a big city, this movie might be interesting. It's a short movie. This evening, Rosenbaum will moderate a panel featuring Hershey Alley and Wall Street Journal columnist Brett Stevens. The discussion will follow a screening of Hershey Alley's short film called Submission, which she created together with the Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh. The latter famously had paid for the film with his life, having been assassinated by a young enraged Muslim in Amsterdam in 2004. A decade later, Van Gogh and Hershey Alley's work is just as capable of provoking rage, this time at the New York University, where they're showing the film. But I'm sure it'll probably get around the country, maybe on other universities. But just remember the name, the title, Submission. If you run into it and it's on the internet, let me know where to find it. Well, that's about it for now. That was probably a rough one to go through, boys and girls. We spent the whole hour with the Jew boys and girls. So anyhow, we'll get back to something more pleasant on tomorrow's show. Well, I don't know. Maybe we'll cover a little more of this. I don't know. We'll see. Whatever moves me. 14-5 and shut your big fat pie hole.